our world has changed fundamentally in the time that I've been alive. And I think even when I started advertising, we still shot TV commercials on film.
Welcome to Haldane's Law Matters. Thank you. So today, I'm delighted to have as a guest Thomas Elliott. And Thomas, I'm going to introduce you by telling listeners that you're an executive producer and creative director, and that you operate in Asia and New Zealand and Australia and well beyond. And you have a raft of famous clients with famous names and in descending order of importance. Haldane's.
Right at the top of the list.
Thank you, Thomas. Coca-Cola and Disney and Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank Corporation, Rolls-Royce and the rest.
Yeah. You know, yeah. Less impactful clients, but that's fine.
Yeah. You started well, Thomas.
Yeah. I mean, a few people might have heard of some of them.
Okay. And you're a master cinematographer?
Yes, indeed.
And an author of 5 books or more? And
that's right. Yeah. 5 books and counting. Writing is something that I do every day. So.
All right. Is that to make a living or is it just really creative output that you enjoy?
I think it's both. I think I find writing to be a wonderful outlet that focuses the brain. So after reading that Stephen King does it every morning and does, I think, something like 1,500 words, I don't do that, but I try and do at least 500 to 1,000 every morning.
Good. Sounds productive. And as a result, you have been the recipient of about 86 and counting again international awards.
Something like that, yes. But who counts after you've got beyond 50 or so?
I know what you mean.
Yeah, it becomes cheap. I just
Okay. All right. And I think it's right to say that you actually made a very nice black and white arty film for Haldane's.
We did. Yeah, we made a series for Haldane's
2 or 3 years ago now. Yeah, time goes.
Time goes so fast.
And I was going to say you actually won some awards for that.
We did. We won, I think, 5 or 6 awards for that.
And we enjoyed the benefits because it was very stylish.
Yeah, it was a great project to work on and to collaborate with you and the team and to kind of tell some stories and I think to show the law in a different light.
And it was John McClellan's initiative.
It was indeed.
As the partner in charge of entertainment and media. So
yes,
it fitted in well. Now, you've made Hong Kong your home, haven't you?
I have, yes.
And not only your home, of course, but also the place where you run your business.
Yes.
And the name of the business?
Casual.
And my first question, if I may, is why Hong Kong? Because you're a business without boundaries. It's not jurisdictional. You choose it.
No, I choose it. Well, I chose it this time around simply because I'd been in Australia for a very long time. I'm from there, obviously, originally. I'm from Tasmania, right down the bottom. And my beautiful wife, who I met in Australia, who is originally from China, she and I embarked on having a child. And when we became pregnant, she decided that she wanted to come back to Hong Kong. And so we came here.
Did you put up resistance to that or were you
happy? No. I was quite happy to come back to Hong Kong. It was hard at the time to find a gig in Hong Kong. All the recruiters wanted to send me to Singapore and we went there a number of times and had lots of lovely meetings with people. A couple of people flew us out and my wife said, this is very nice, but no, I don't want to live in Singapore. I really want to live in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And then I got a phone call from a recruiter who said, oh, there's a business. Oh, you won't have heard of them. And I went, okay, well, I've been to Hong Kong a lot and I know a lot of people. And she said, oh, no, I'm sure you won't have heard of them. And I said, well, who are they? And she said, APV. I went, Mark Erter and Angela Chung. Yes, I know them. I know who they are. And she said, well, they're looking for somebody. And I went, okay. And so I think I spoke to Angela for about 15 minutes and then Mark for about 10. And a week later, I sold my house, my car, gave away my dog. My wife and I were on a plane and back living in our apartment in Hong Kong. And I've been here for 7 years since. So
let's. May I go back in time now?
You may.
So tell us just a little bit about your childhood and your education that's led to where you are today.
Sure. So I grew up in Tasmania, in Launceston, which is in the northern part of the state. It's a very beautiful place, and I think growing up there in the sort of late 1970s, early 1980s, all the way through to the 90s was a good childhood. I think, and we kind of touched upon this in the conversation we had the other day, that life was quite different then. And if you grow up in a small provincial town where there's less than a couple hundred thousand people, life is very different and your friends don't have common interests. And I was lucky to grow up in a family where my parents entertained things. So my sister and I both learnt music. So from a young age, I learnt the violin and then I transitioned to guitar and other instruments. And I sort of had a seminal moment in my childhood where my father, he trained as a vet, but he worked for the government. And he had a passing interest in films and he was the secretary of the Launceston Film Society when I was a child. And his favorite film was 2001, A Space Odyssey. And it was playing in 65mm. So he took my brother and I recall going in my pajamas to go and see 2001, A Space Odyssey. And it was the full thing. So you had the overture, you had the film, you had the intermission. So the end of it. And I remember at the end of that film, my brother hated the entire experience. I mean, that's the worst film I've ever seen. I walked out of it and went, I want to do that.
So it was your seminal moment.
That was pretty much my seminal moment. And then I pretty much was in and out of cinemas the rest of my life and got to the point where I finished high school and looked at doing other things. And I think my parents very much, having grown up in Tasmania, where something like working in the film industry is not considered a legitimate or serious profession that you can into.
I can imagine.
Was sort of advised, well, maybe you try something else. And I did that for a bit and then dropped out and then got into the VCA, which is one of the top film schools in Australia. And I did the 3-year undergraduate there in film and television. And that was a wonderful course because it was very hands-on and it had a lot of things. And I guess I focused in on cinematography when I was at film school, probably for very practical reasons. I thought that at the end of this, everybody's going to want to come out and be a director and I kind of want a job. And I felt being a cinematographer would be good for that. So I did that. I then ended up doing a master's in cinematography at the AFTRS and came out as a cinematographer. So did that for a number of years, and then advertising agencies and video production companies discovered that I had a series of useful skills, I guess, outside of cinematography. I could write, I could produce, I was good with money, I could manage people. And so I sort of slowly transitioned from being a cinematographer to a director to then other kind of roles within agencies. And then I think when the transition from television advertising to online advertising happened, I sort of became a creative director and then worked for large companies like WPP and Dentsu doing that.
So we'll talk a bit more about how the world of advertising and selling effectively has transitioned. But before we do, so you like myself, because I grew up in rural Yorkshire, came from a very rural background. Do you ever get a pang to go back to that?
Not so much. I mean, I went back a couple of years ago with my daughter for Christmas, and I felt that was a good experience for her to have, to come and see Tasmania and to go and it's a very beautiful place, Jonathan.
Yes. I haven't been to Tasmania. It's on my list.
You should definitely go. It's very beautiful. Like Japan, it has seasons that make it very different. It's a wonderful place to go. I just couldn't live there. It's very...
Ever? Retire?
No.
Well, you're too young to.
Well, no, but I've said to
Thomas, you're too young to know.
Probably too young to retire. But I've said to my parents, yeah, it's not for me. It's a little bit parochial. And I think I'm very much a big city person. I like cities. I like people. I like the interactions that you have every day. Looking at the mountains is nice, Jonathan, for a break.
Yes.
Couldn't do it all the time.
I understand. Now, you've touched on a topic that I want to explore with you, if you'll forgive me for doing so, because it is the idea of the way in which, over my lifetime and yours, in fact, filmmaking and selling through films has moved, because there was a time when we hadn't invented the fax machine, never mind. So we go back a bit. But in any event, give me, if you will, a few moments on your thoughts about the transition from, say, the analog world into the digital world and what it has impacted.
Our world has changed fundamentally in the time that I've been alive. And I think even when I started advertising, we still shot TV commercials on film, and they were expensive, very expensive exercises to do. There were only brands who could really afford to do film, did film. And the technicians and the people that were required to put together a TV commercial were almost as large as if you were putting together a feature film or anything else. A lot of talent went into doing that kind of work. I think what the online space and social media has certainly opened up for brands, and the transition to digital technology, is that it has made filmmaking vastly more accessible. And I think now also the device that we all carry with us everywhere changed everything, because once you have a mobile phone and you have video on that phone, you're able to communicate with people every day. And what do you see people do when you see them on the MTR or you see them on the street? They're there with their headphones on, glued to a screen, watching stuff.
Yeah.
That really changed the game for brands. And I think also the fact that digital technology got cheaper, it made it more accessible, it has made the marketplace for filmmaking very wide and varied. There are very experienced, expensive businesses you can go to. There are people who are just starting out who have the same equipment. And really the only differentiator in the marketplace is skill and storytelling skill and the ability to use those skills to tell a story in a persuasive way that has an impact for a brand, business or organization. So yeah, I think it's changed a lot. I think also in a way businesses have had to become more sophisticated around video because it is everywhere. It is a great way to tell very human stories. And I think that's the other difference. When I started off in advertising, you really were selling to people. It was, here's an attractive person on a beach drinking a product. great, I want to go and buy that product. And we've kind of moved away from that.
There was a simplicity about those.
Yeah, there was a sort of naive, innocent simplicity to it. But I think people have become very aware of advertising now as well. And I think also streaming and shows like Mad Men have made people very understanding of traditional advertising practices. People know when they're being sold. So that has also changed the way that we tell stories.
So when I introduced you, I brought into play the idea that you'd actually made a film for us. In fact, two in slightly different formats. Yep. And when I was thinking that you would be a guest on this podcast, the title would be Selling the Law.
Because yeah.
In some senses, our relationship with you has been in an effort to sell the law, to
yep.
sell Haldanes. I mean, that's why we make these films, so that people can see who we are. So if there are other law firms listening, you can do yourself a favor. You might get the business. How do we sell the law and service industries? Because we're not selling a glossy Mercedes-Benz
no.
or a washing machine.
You're not. I think the key thing to this is understanding what makes each law firm unique. Haldanes obviously has a number of practice areas that they deal in, from criminal to corporate law and other areas, matrimonial, etc. And I think one of the things that law firms can do that they often underestimate is their people. Their people make fantastic stories, because at the end of the day, regardless of what you need a lawyer for, and everybody in business needs a lawyer for something, many need them in their personal lives as well. But at the end of the day, that relationship is a relationship built between people. It is about my lawyer is the right lawyer for me for the reasons that I need them. And so I think a great opportunity for law firms is to humanize themselves. I do feel that, again, when you look at the transition of industries and how they're being portrayed in video, law is one that has been a little bit slower to change in Asia. In Australia, there are law firms who use things like community television and have full one-hour programs on TV on a Saturday morning where they interview people and tell stories that benefit their law firm. I know a number of people who've worked on shows like that. They do case study videos that explain why they are right for a particular type of law or a particular type of client. They create films about trainees and people who've joined them, similar, in fact, to what we've done for Haldanes.
Yes. Now, can I just, you were saying that they create films where they try and show why they're the right firm for whoever's listening
yep.
or watching. We'll come on to the distinction between that in a minute.
Yep.
Is that the best way to sell in your view, or is a more subliminal approach preferable?
It sort of depends on how you do it. I mean, I think case studies are always very persuasive. If they're done in the right fashion where they tell a story, and often you might see that for people who deal with forms of industrial law that might deal with accidents or other bits and pieces, you'll often see a lot of case studies. I think that's quite persuasive, because often people don't know where to start when they have to find somebody in that area. And so looking at a case study and looking at it and going, well, that's sort of similar in the realms of the problem I might have.
So that's a fairly linear look at the thing.
It is, yeah.
Now, when you were saying that, when you were talking about that, it made me think of something that was in the news about a month ago, maybe 2 months ago now. And that was the relaunch of Jaguar.
Yes.
So which was super offbeat.
Yeah.
What do we think about that?
I loved it. I loved everything about it.
So for listeners that weren't watching that story, Jaguar rebranded themselves. They had a new logo, and they had an advertising campaign that didn't seem to have very much to do with motor cars.
It didn't feature a single motor car.
No. And there was quite a lot of outrage for Jaguar
yes.
lovers. You know,
yes.
Where's the motor car? Where's that old English leather seat and so on?
Yep. But I think Jaguar would have been very happy with the results. I mean, you know,
talked about internationally,
made all the headlines, got them more publicity than they would have got if they'd done a traditional ad spot. And I think, again, when you're talking about somebody like Jaguar, who has a certain reputation, and I think, again, built off the fact that they used to make handmade cars and they used to have a certain reputation around that, almost as good as a Rolls or a Bentley. Very much so. And I think, again, a sort of very traditional motor enthusiast audience. I think the idea that taking that away and saying, well, no, actually, because the world of motor vehicles has changed. It's more competitive than it's ever been. We have to change. We have to adapt to the audience. But there is value in the heritage of our brand. And I think that's a thing that a lot of brands who are smart understand, is that they don't talk about the history of their brand. They talk about the heritage, because heritage is something that I think we've learnt to except from the fashion industry. Brands like Louis Vuitton do a great job of talking about heritage instead of talking about history, because it is the inherent wisdom that has built up over years that adds value to the brand. And I think Jaguar understood that, but they also understood they had to change. We are dealing with a marketplace where the switch to electronic vehicles is here. It's no longer something we fantasize about. The future is here and it's going to be silent. And it's a competitive space.
It was a brave move.
Very brave move. But I think in the end,
Did you like the advert?
No, I loved it. I mean, in a similar way, I really liked a number of years ago, Nike did a spot with Colin Kaepernick. That obviously he's a very controversial figure in the US because of his kneeling during the national anthem football games. But that spot to me said everything about Nike. And the pandemonium it created amongst certain people who were burning their Nikes and ridiculous behavior. But all of that, share price went up, you know. Nike was worth another $2 billion more at the end of it.
So the message is be brave.
Yeah, be brave.
Be inventive.
Bold. Don't be boring.
Before you were born, probably, I remember an advert that's always stuck in my mind. And it was Guinness, the drink, the Irish drink, Guinness.
Yep.
And from memory, it had an absolutely black background, which fits the drink, of course, that velvety black.
Mm.
And it said, I think, something like, I don't like Guinness. And then at the bottom, I've never tried it.
Well, yeah.
And it sticks.
It sticks, yeah.
You know.
And people remember it and...
I do.
Yeah. And I think that's another crucial lesson. If you tell a story and you tell it in a boring fashion that nobody remembers, what was the point of telling it?
Yes.
People very quickly now too, you'll see this on phones because we're being fed so much information all the time and we're used to scrolling past things. If it's not interesting, I'm not going to watch
it. 3 seconds is slow.
3 seconds is slow, yeah.
Let's broaden the topic because we've talked specifically about your background and how you've become to be an important figure in Hong Kong's filmmaking and advertising. And let's talk about the mediums that are actually out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that, for example, YouTube, Instagram, LinkedIn.
Yep.
What do you say about those? Are they a crucial part of the message now?
I think there are sort of three key areas that we look at with brands, which is your owned, earned, and bought media or paid media.
Let's say that again.
Owned.
Yeah.
Earned. And paid.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so your owned media is your website. It belongs to you. It's your URL. You own it. You can do whatever you want with it. That's yours. Earned is what you're going to get through social media. So sites like LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, WeChat. I mean, there's thousands more once you go across the border. Even Douyin and TikTok and bits and pieces like that.
It's a red book.
Little red book. And then obviously paid media is where people do things like paid on social. So that is pay to play on Facebook, on pre-roll ads on YouTube. It extends to things like out of home advertising or even television advertising, which despite a lot of pundits saying television advertising is going to die, has not died. And it continues to exist because people still watch free to air television.
Do they?
Yeah, they do.
An aerial on the roof and it's trusted.
Well, I think it's all done by cable now. And at some point, the streaming people will introduce some form of advertising. It's going to happen because revenue will have to go up and that will happen. That will become the new normal. So those kinds of paid media still exist. And I think in a lot of ways, it is having a good combination of those three things that contributes to real brand success. By having a great website that once people get there, it's easy to use. It has all the things that people are looking for on there. I think video has increasingly become a big component in that, particularly in areas like employer branding. When people come onto your website, they don't want to just hear that you're a great place to work. They want to see that you're a great place to work.
Right.
Likewise, client testimonials have become a fantastic thing for people because people go on there and somebody tells them, well, don't take it from them that they say they're great. I had a great experience. All of those things contribute value. I think social media is massive if it's used correctly. And I think LinkedIn in particular, the value for brands, it's not just a B2B space. There are customers on there. There are people who come. I think particularly if you're something like a law firm, a lot of your customers are on LinkedIn.
we work it.
Yeah. And you have to. And I think, again, since it was acquired by Microsoft, I think LinkedIn has done a wonderful job in kind of diversifying the platform. They've pushed video very strongly. It makes major benefits to the algorithm when you do it. You do it regularly. And obviously, if you're encouraging people to engage with your content, then it's working
better,
for you even stronger.
Yep. Can you overuse it? Can you saturate it? Can you bore people?
Well, you can. I mean, I think it's repetitive messaging on social media platforms that doesn't add value, I think, is one of the worst crimes that a lot of brands commit. Just putting the same thing out over and over and over and over again with little thought of how the audience is reacting to it. I think smart brands are looking for an interesting, diverse mix on their social media, whether it is a combination of things that do sell a little bit more overtly, combined with things that are a little bit more human. And I think also the fact that we're all now used to seeing different types of content. Even in the video space, people are very used to seeing very polished content, but they're also used to seeing very self-shot, user-generated content that people do on their phone.
Which is okay.
Which is totally okay. And I think in a lot of ways, it's having the bravery to do that and to make yourself accessible in that way. And I think that's a big challenge for a lot of brands.
How videos versus just a photograph and the written word?
Photographs still work. I think it's having a combination. I'm certainly not somebody who sits here and says video is the be all and end all of everything, because it's not true. It is a combination strategy. I mean, even within our own brand at Casual, because we are a global brand, we're all over the world, we get great results from still images. We get great results from articles. We get great results from having a combination of things that our audience looks at. I mean, even in Hong Kong last year, we launched a newsletter on our LinkedIn channel, which is something we hadn't done before. And that's now got over 7,000 subscribers.
Goodness,
who are constantly interested in the content that we put out.
And you have your own podcast.
And we have our own podcast, which was something that, again, we initiated because we felt there was an interest in it. And
I'm going to give you the permission to mention its name.
So it's called The Content Combo. It is on Apple, Spotify, and every other major platform you can find a podcast on. We are doing a second season, which will be released in February, and with a couple of new hosts in a different format. So we're, again, learning from what we're doing and evolving, which I think is something that everybody should do. You look back at how something performed, and you make adjustments, and that's okay.
Now, then you've got content, which is important, which we're talking about there, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the actual launch of it. You've got to inject it into the public. Otherwise, in a very crowded space, it just disappears, however good it is.
Yeah. I think there's a number of things. I mean, awareness is the key to everything. I often say to people, one of the best marketing strategies you can look at that has existed for over 100 years is if you go to your local cinema, which not many people do anymore because they watch stuff online. But if you go, before you go and pay an exorbitant amount of money at the candy bar and you're walking along, you'll see a poster, you'll see a key image that tells you, you know, the latest Avengers movie or something is coming. And that's a key piece of art that you look at and you kind of consider and you go, okay, great.
You'll be attracted to it or you won't.
You'll be attracted to it or you won't, but it builds awareness.
It's the cover of the book argument.
It is. It builds awareness.
For sure.
And then when you have paid for your movie ticket and you've splashed out at the candy bar and you've walked all the way along, you've seen more posters on your way to the cinema and then you've sat down, what's the next thing that happens? Trailers come on, which are short little teaser pieces of information that, again, feed you information about something. They build awareness and you look at them and go, oh, okay, I'm starting to form an opinion as to whether I want to go and see that. You'll then see, if you're on traditional television, you'll see they'll start running TV ads online. They'll start running pre-roll and other bits and pieces, and they're drip feeding you bits of information that are changing your view.
So podcasts, how do you promote your podcasts?
We did a number of things. So obviously, I have the benefit of 90,000 followers on LinkedIn.
Thomas, why isn't it 100?
I'm trying desperately, Jonathan.
This could tip the balance.
I feel like this is why I'm here today, that being on Law Matters will definitely tip the balance for me. So that already gives me a great opportunity to launch something, right? And then also being part of a global brand like Casual are able to reshare my content. And I think this is another thing that brands should really embrace, is if individuals within a business doing things that are beneficial to the business, sharing them on the business channel helps. Obviously, then we did little teasers. We had some photos taken in our recording session that we put out. We made some snappy, persuasive cover art that came out. And also every episode, I went to great lengths to promote on LinkedIn. We promoted it on our newsletter. We promoted it on our e-newsletter, which we send out to certain clients. And so we were able to build an audience attention of people who at least would consider listening to it, which I think is the first step. And then what was great is people did actually listen to it and found it surprisingly entertaining, always a win.
Yeah.
And then they talked about it to other people. And word of mouth in everything is everything. If you share your podcast on your LinkedIn, on your Instagram or on other channels.
More sharing
is good. I think also when people comment, so if people comment, I listened to the latest episode, Jonathan, it was great. Replying to that comment is really important.
Yes.
I'm really glad you liked it.
Yes.
What else would you be interested in hearing?
Absolutely. And it's polite too.
But that, in a way, makes you accessible to your audience. It makes them feel like, well, yes, I enjoyed it, but yes, no, I might be interested in hearing this. And you know what? They've taken on my feedback. They've done a story on it. That's great.
And the graphic art in terms of...
Yeah, I think that's also important. I mean, we last year focused on having sort of a four presenters talking kind of model for our podcast, which alleviated the burden of one host and a guest or one host doing the whole thing. And it gives you four different personalities who are very different. This year, we're going to vary it. We're going to vary the combo. So I will probably be the regular host, but there will be different members making up the team every podcast.
Do you YouTube it?
We haven't YouTubed it yet, but we're going to do that this season. So it,
do you recommend it?
I think it depends. I would recommend it for you because I think that you have a great personality and you would work well on YouTube. It sort of depends on, because once you're adding visuals, right, it's a visual medium. People have to be great on camera. And I think the challenge for some podcasts, like I've listened to some, like, because I have to for work, financial podcasts or other bits and pieces. And I could imagine that those hosts would be terrible if video was suddenly interjected because they just don't have that presence or they're not great on camera.
The most successful podcast in England is the one with Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart.
Yep.
The rest is politics.
Yeah.
And leading.
Yeah.
And I see they've added a YouTube.
Yeah, but Alistair Campbell's fantastically interesting person.
Yeah. Well, they both are, I think, actually. They're both tremendous. And they deserve to be the most successful podcast.
They do. Yeah.
An amazing job.
Yeah.
But I was thinking for myself, I don't actually watch the YouTube particularly. I might watch it for 10 seconds and flick it off to save data.
Yep. I think it sort of depends on what it is. Like, I think the video format has worked quite well for people like Joe Rogan in the US, because again, that's a very unique podcast format. You're talking about 3 hours of talking to people. Again, because he can push the needle any way he wants to with what he wants to talk about.
Yeah.
And the guests that he gets are pretty premium guests, including...
As we do with course, you today.
Yes. Maybe you'll get Donald Trump on here.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
Yeah.
Actually, you've given me a segue very neatly because in talking about Joe Rogan and people that are actually moving the needle very often politically and socially is a wonderfully rich seam when it comes to talking about social media. Because the concerns for parents, politicians, for companies.
For everybody.
About the growth of social media is topical today. It was yesterday and it will be tomorrow. It's huge.
Yep.
So let's just broaden out to the international impact on society and decide if we may today. Firstly, what the impact is and what you're going to do about it.
Well, I think the impact is massive. As I said to you the other day, I'm very glad that I grew up in a time where social media didn't exist.
Me too. But
I think that would have been an awful element of my childhood had social media existed.
And
I think
tragic in many cases.
And for a lot of people I grew up with, it would have been very tragic.
Are you a father?
I am, yeah. So I have a 6 and a half.
Oh, you've got it to come. I have a 19-year-old.
Yeah, no. But it's already of interest. Yeah. And I would applaud the decision of governments like the Australian government recently saying that they're going to put a ban on social media for children up until the age of 15 or 16. I think that's very smart.
Yeah. Is it going to happen?
It is going to happen.
Yeah. In Australia?
In Australia, yeah. And I mean, how you police that, I don't know. But the idea of at least saying we believe this is harmful to children
is the start
because it does shape opinions very quickly. And we have seen whole movements that have come out of social media overnight that have massive ramifications on the way that we live. Some of those are positive, some of them are not positive. The Me Too movement is something that we all remember massively coming out and having a massive impact in a very short period of time. Some of that was very positive, some of that was not necessarily positive and has had long-lasting impacts on the way that we will live in the future. I think the ability of people who really shouldn't have a say in politics, moving the needle on politics. I mean, we can all look at Mr. Musk's involvements in British and American politics at the moment.
I was about to mention him. Interestingly, on an interview I listened to recently on YouTube, a serious interview and quite a long one, he interestingly said that he thought it was essential that social media was quickly brought under government control in the same way as the aviation industry is, the motor car industry and other things where there's the potential for dangerous social impact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not what I normally associate with Elon Musk's view.
No.
But it was said in seriousness and thoughtful language.
Yes, but then I would say that on the same card as that, I think he very much views that as it depends on which government you're talking about. And I think he's probably quite happy that the government he's contributing large money as a donor to, he'd probably be quite happy with them doing it. But he did criticise the Australian government quite severely for the social media laws that were being introduced there because of his perception of how that will affect his share price for Twitter and other business enterprises he's involved in.
So he's got various views on this that are very personal to his own interests. Is that
I think he does. Yeah. And again, I think we spend too much time listening to him. I think that's probably my advice for a lot of people. I mean, just because he makes good cars doesn't mean we should be listening to him on any social policy or anything else. In the same way that I find it amazing the amount of people who really value the opinion of actors and
I was going to say entertainers, you know, with their political views.
You know, you're talking about people who learn lines for a living. Why do I care who they vote for?
It's the personality cult. The power of personality.
Yeah. I would say social media has been really great for business in a lot of ways in sharing stories, but also I do think we have to ask ourselves as a society, is giving a mouthpiece to everybody to talk about whatever they're thinking about at any given moment really great for society? I'm not sure that it is.
The argument's always free speech, but
it is.
It's a lazy way of dealing with it.
It is a really lazy way of dealing with it. And I think the fact is it's going to get lazier because you now see people like Mr. Zuckerberg saying, well, we're not going to police what people say anymore, or we're going to relax our content filters because it's too hard. It's too hard to have the truth on Facebook. It's too hard to have the truth on other channels. And I think I heard somebody say the other day, and I think it's true, it's getting harder and harder to discern what reality means globally anymore, because for a good part of the last century, truth has been the bastion of journalism. It has been something that we look at and hold up as a pillar. I think even in recent histories, online efforts like WikiLeaks to uncover truth and do other bits and pieces had a great positive impact. But then you also see the flip side of that, and you see growing anti-Semitism around the world. You see conspiracy theories about things that are just crazy.
And people lap it up.
And people do. And I think that's the scary thing, because also we've just gone through a pandemic that made everybody more isolationist. We have gone through other things that have changed the way we live. And people really hold on to their devices and they take a lot of information in every day. And in the same way that I was talking about the cinema and how those small bits of information lead to you forming views, social media does that to you all the time. And I was great. I was watching a thing, I'm going to forget his name now, but the Simon Sinek, the why guy. And he was talking about if you're having to take your phone into every room you go into, even after work, you've probably got a problem. Yeah, you know, and when you start taking it to the bathroom, and there'll be a lot of people listening to this going, God, I take my phone to the bathroom all the time. But, you know.
We talked about it the other day, Thomas, when we had lunch. There's a good judgment from the Supreme Court in America because the police were stopping somebody to see what they were carrying, and they were carrying a mobile phone. They wanted to see the interior, and somebody challenged that in the courts.
Mm-hmm.
And because you'll appreciate that in the old days, and still today, actually, the police can't enter a home, for example.
Yep.
Without the permission of a judge. They need the warrant. And the Supreme Court in America, to some people's surprise, said, look, if an alien came down to Earth, they would be forgiven for believing that an iPhone or a Samsung mobile phone was actually a part of the body of a human being.
Yep.
They're constantly in the hand and they contain everything about that person's life.
Yes.
You need a warrant to look inside it.
Yep.
So the fact of the matter is the mobile phone and the digital world has changed everything.
It has, yeah.
And it's continuing to do so. And we touched on the truth.
Mm.
AI.
Yeah.
That's going to make life even more difficult, isn't it? When it's looking for the truth, we don't know where to find it.
Well, it is, because AI is only as good as the information that programs it. And that is, and again, if you look at the way that it sorts through information, is the same way that a lot of computers sort through information, is that it finds the most topical responses to things. If you Google something, it will tell you, well, of the top 3 million options you had available, this was the version that was most popular, so therefore it's possibly true. Doesn't mean it is true.
I heard something the other day, more accurately. There was a talk show, and Michael Parkinson, of course, who has been dead, sadly, for 2, 3, or 4 years, I can't remember now, but he's dead.
Yep.
Was hosting it.
Oh, wow.
Because someone had imposed Parkinson's voice over the interviewer.
Wow.
So Michael Parkinson sounded as if he was hosting the show.
Wow.
And I thought that was intriguing, you know.
Yeah, well, even, I mean, in recent weeks, we've seen a number of celebrities coming out to also say, look, I'm now being used as part of an AI scam. I think Johnny Depp was the most recent one. And he said, again, if you're receiving emails from my team saying, please donate $50,000 and you'll have some kind of opportunity with Johnny. That's not me. I will never ask you for money. Morgan Freeman, I think, has become the most duplicated AI voice on the planet and has actually started vast amounts of litigation to find people who are using his AI generated voice to spruik their products or to appear in short films or other things that he has not given permission for his voice to be used for. it's a challenging area. I mean, like a lot of things, like social media, like digital technology, it offers a lot of benefits.
Do you use it as a business?
We do. We use it a lot. It has vastly improved the way that we work in a lot of ways that people probably wouldn't expect. So for instance, subtitling used to be a really laborious manual task. AI now is able to basically extract what people are saying and create subtitles. They're not 100% accurate, but they do reduce the work hours of creating subtitles. So for a 3 to 4 minute film, that might have originally taken an hour, 2 hours for somebody to do the subtitles. Now they can do them in 20 minutes. And that's a big saving for our business. But it is AI generated. And we do small things like in our business, we often deal with user generated content that people film. Sometimes they don't film it very well. AI is useful to do things like stabilize the content, to up-res it from standard resolution to 4K resolution, to even more advanced uses. We did a piece for a company where we replaced all the backgrounds with AI because the backgrounds didn't look nice. It was self-shot. So we created new backgrounds, and using AI was wonderful because you could suddenly do things like, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could use the brand color and all the furniture in the background we're creating? And AI can do that. You can program it to do that. And again, it is another one of those things. Our industry is constantly facing a barrage of people saying, well, this is the thing that's going to kill video. Now it will all be AI. I can tell you unequivocally that's not true, because AI, again, is only as good as the people who program it. It's not there yet.
It's not there yet, but I'm so sorry. Yeah. I'm going to mention the name Musk again.
Yeah.
It's the same YouTube that I was listening to, where he said if you go forward 20 to 30 years, society will have nothing to do with what we have today. It would change society entirely.
Yep.
And one of the points I think he was trying to make, well, he wasn't trying to make, he made, I was trying to understand it, was something along the lines that it will, in fact, supersede human beings, but in the sense that they will be a million times faster at processing.
Yep.
And the time will come when they will have their own ability to run themselves and use that processing power.
I don't even think we're talking about 30 years. I mean, we've looked at the new quantum computers that they've developed, that they're finally apparently made work for the first time, that were able to solve a math problem that would have taken the entire existence of human time on this planet to solve.
Yes.
Right. And it solved it in 5 minutes.
And then you've got chess champions being beaten by. So we could end up, couldn't we, with, I mean, human beings may be going to get, this could be the new human race, if you know what I mean.
Again, this is why it's really important to discuss these things. And I think one of the things that we talk about, and one of the things that we're actually engaged with a lot of our clients about now, is what are their AI principles?
Yeah.
You know, how are they going to use it? How are they going to govern it within their business? How do they see that being appropriate? And I think that's an important question to ask. And I think it's important for governments to ask as well, because again, uncontrolled and unchecked in the way that social media has been for the past 20 something years, who knows where it could go?
And for lawyers, of course.
And for lawyers as well, you know, because again, when you're talking about the truth in a legal sense, it's very important. You know,
to get it right.
To get it right. Where the comma goes, where the full stop goes, everything is important.
There have been cases, you may know, where lawyers have used AI and not checked it properly and got into big, big trouble.
Mm. I'm not surprised.
But I'm told we're a bit behind the eight ball on this with AI, but I'm told there are law firms that have divisions now dealing with AI and its application within the practice, the legal practice.
There are, even within Hong Kong.
Are there, yeah.
Yeah, I know we've done a story on one of them.
Oh, right. Okay, well, we're talking about it.
We came up about it, yeah.
It's an important part of life.
It is, it is. And I think, again, the challenges for everybody is how we deal with it, how we use it to its benefit and not its detriment. I would say I watched a film recently made by a major insurance company that I thought was a horrible use of AI, really horrible, because they used real people's stories, genuine customer stories, but the imagery was all created with AI, so it's not real people and it's not real stories. And I would say the disconnect between those two things, when you're talking about a business that is a life business, is it about people, is it about their stories, to use somebody's real story and to apply AI imagery to it, to me, is fundamentally the worst thing a brand like that could do. And the fact that nobody's criticized them for it amazes me. And I will be the first to criticize them for it, because I think it's terrible.
I think there is such a saturation of difficult things in the world that people stop criticizing because it becomes just too much.
Yeah.
It becomes too much.
It does. And also, I think there's the fear of criticizing things because, again, we worry that somebody will... Yeah.
Ping pong situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, I'm all for free speech. I'm all for people expressing their opinions. I grew up in a town where I would not agree with a lot of people's opinions, but I had to get along with them.
But disagree agreeably.
Yes. Hear them out. And I think that's something we could all learn from is, in any situation, hear them out. Yeah. Try and understand how they've come to that view in the first place.
Try and blend ideas rather than polarizing.
Exactly. We get a lot better as a society when we move towards the middle rather than moving towards the two sides opposite each other.
Well, on that note, because there's a whole new subject arising there with the whole political world. We'll have you back, Thomas. Thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure.
Coming across to us today, and I've enjoyed talking to you, and we could talk all day.
We could indeed.
But we're going to go and have a coffee now.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.